I'm Gord Price, and this is Price Talks. I have some advice for those of you who are interested in cities, maybe just newly arrived. Get your bicycle, use your feet if you wish, but I recommend bikes, and choose a SkyTrain station. And then go any direction you want, but try and explore the side streets. Take a look at the various communities that have been built over time. Get a sense of the fabric of the city. And always look at everyone you pass by. Take a glance. See who they are. Who lives in a place. One of the best examples I can remember after I moved to Vancouver, I guess it was the 80s, I chose King George Station, and I went south. I thought I would get as far as Newton. And I wound my way through the suburban streets that had probably been laid out in the 50s and 60s. And yeah, there were the split-level houses. It was classic suburbia. Only the difference is that everyone I saw pretty much was, hey, South Asian, Sikh, Punjabi. I didn't exactly know what to call, but I could see, I wouldn't call it exactly an alternate universe. Everything looked like it came out of a situation comedy from the 1950s. There were the, you know, the vans and the, I guess, SUVs of that time. The lawns were all mowed. It was just classic. And yet, it reflected a change, a profound one, that had occurred to this part of the region. I live in the West End today. And I discovered that if everyone who lives on the downtown peninsula, from the West End to Yale Town, Coal Harbor to the North Shore of False Creek, if they say the men were basically wearing turbans and the women saris, and everyone who lived on the downtown peninsula was South Asian, that would be roughly the population of Sikhs in Surrey today. Over 100,000 people. So that gives you some sense of what's happening to this region that was built with a certain culture and place in mind as various tides of immigration sweep over it, as more people come here from other places and build their lives and have their children and live the good life in Canada. So I thought, wouldn't it be great to talk with someone who was here early and watched that transition and could give me insight into the reality of living here, of coming here, of being part of a community, of seeing the change, the politics. I asked my friend Sukh Johal, we interviewed him for a previous podcast, is there someone you could direct me to, introduce me to? And he did. Sitting across from me is Gyan Sikh Sandhu. Welcome, sir.
Thank you very much, Gord.
Have I pronounced your name correctly?
Absolutely. You've done better than me.
Ha! And if I wanted to say welcome to you or hello in Punjabi, what would I say?
Jiyanu. Jiyanu.
Jiyan?
No, Jiyanu.
Jiyanu. Well, since Punjabi is the fourth most spoken language in Canada, it would be a good idea to have a few words.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. Yeah. Now, is it true that almost all of the South Asians in this region are Punjabi?
Not necessarily. If you go back maybe 30 years, you could say that 90% were Punjabi, but right now it's not. I would say 50-50.
And are all Punjabis Sikh?
All Punjabis are majority Sikhs.
In here?
Yeah.
And how large a community is it?
Well, in British Columbia, we have in excess of 250,000. So of that, Lower Mainland is actually home to about 200,000. So if you were saying about Surrey, Surrey, I would say, is in the range of 125,000.
125. Well, that is exactly the population of the downtown peninsula.
Yeah.
And if you all lived in one place, that would be what? I don't know, maybe the third largest city in British Columbia?
Absolutely.
Yeah. When did you come here?
I came in 1970.
Trudeau was the prime minister.
Things I had an opportunity to, in fact, meet him.
Yeah.
At that time.
Where are you from?
I'm from north of India, Punjab.
And whereabouts in the Punjab?
A place called Rourkelaan, R-U-R-K-A-K-L-A-N. It's a town of about 10,000 people.
10,000. And that would be a small little village almost?
It's a village there compared to, I think, Canada. It will be a reasonably good fair-sized town.
Because we focus in on urban design and development, describe for me the home that you grew up in, what that looked like and what it was like when you walked out your door, maybe on the way to school.
Well, when you look back, actually 1943, actually, when I was born, I grew up in a joint family house, a fairly good-sized house, about eight bedroom or so. And as you walked out of the house to the school, you looked around and you had your books. Actually, we didn't have the books supplied by schools. You had to carry everything. And you didn't even know which book to carry sometimes. So I think the bags were heavier than what your own weight was. And I think it was a nice fun.
How long to get to school?
For me, actually, to the elementary school was about 15 minutes. Not bad.
Oh, that's not bad.
Yeah, when we went to high school, it was about half an hour walk.
And you would walk?
We would all walk.
Yeah. People use bicycles.
Bicycles came later on, to be very honest. Mm-hmm. Every family was not blessed with a bike.
How common would a car be?
Cars was very, very, very uncommon. You would say in the town of 10,000 people, you could see maybe one or two cars.
Now, did most people live in what we would call a single-family house, albeit very large family?
Basically large family. When you talk about joint family systems, you had uncles, aunts. In my case, I had two of my uncles and their family. So I grew up with my cousins, five of them. So and then sister and I, seven of us, actually grew up in the same household.
Was it the Punjabi equivalent of a Vancouver special?
You could call it.
Uh-huh. Yeah. We'll go back to that. I think there's absolutely a connection. Yeah. Now, did you have a garden associated with the house?
We had farms. Most Sikhs actually that you see in Canada definitely come from a farming family background. Each one of them having acreage, depending the sizes from which area you come in, anywhere from 2 to 5 acres to 20, 30, 50, or hundreds of acres, some of them. Our family had about 21 acres.
And you grew all the food you needed on that?
Not only food. We grew a lot of wheat, sugarcane, rice, you talk about all the vegetables. And obviously, we were selling those crops, and that was the source of income.
Huh. And would your story be typical of the time that you came here? Would most of South Asian immigrants, Punjabi immigrants, been in similar circumstances?
I would call typical in a sense that when I came to Canada in 1970, people had already paid some price, actually, for being here for the past, say, 70 years or so, because the first Sikh landed in Canada in 1897. So they were here for 73 years almost when I came. But challenges were still there. Their challenges were different than the ones we faced when I came. And my challenges was certainly because we were reasonably educated. You came along and the language was not a barrier for me. So I would say it's a bit not that common actually with people coming. But
well, that's huge.
It's you a huge advantage.
English.
Absolutely.
What was that typically taught at school?
English was taught in schools. In my times when we went to school, we had options to take from after the elementary school when we went to junior. We could either take the English as an option or take Punjabi or Hindi as an option. So I opted to take English.
You were literate.
I would say reasonably.
All right. Now, what reputation? Well, let me ask this question. Why did you come to British Columbia? Why did this place appeal to you or your family?
My family roots through my wife are actually going back to 1904. Her grandfather came here in 1904. Now you can visualize and imagine actually the challenges he went through and the stories we heard back certainly were challenging. Then my brother-in-law and my mother-in-law were up here. So obviously we were not partially really left alone to manage on our own. So we came to join a family. So our transition was a bit easier.
Absolutely. Is this typical that there would be a family link for most of the immigrants who would have come around that time as you?
For some, yes, but not necessarily. For majority came actually as visitors because of the changes in the immigration regs in 1967, which allowed people to really come here as visitors if they liked it, apply to stay here, and they were allowed to stay, but they had to be assessed based upon the point system, which was the educations and their reasonability of adjusting into the Canadian system and finding a job type of things and the language skill. So these were the criteria. If they had somebody else to assess them to settle, that gave them a few points as well.
We need a name for refugees of that time. Because, yes, there were major changes to Canada immigration policy, the point system being only one of them.
Yeah.
Did you feel like you were part of a tide?
I personally didn't, to be very honest, because I landed in a small community. And you're pretty much a number. You're easily identifiable person with a turban.
You're a unicorn.
I was a unicorn, actually. You could easily identify from a distance, and that wasn't the issue for me. But I think there was a tide in a sense, actually, in the Lower Mainland or major Canadian centers.
Absolutely. Yeah, I did find some interesting numbers when you go back and look that at the time of the major who came here, the first, 1897,
yeah,
even by about 1907, there was 1,500 Sikhs at that time. And I think by the 1940s, around 5,000. So that's a very small, increase.
Well, Canada wasn't a welcoming country, let's face it. When I go back and look at it and say that people try to challenge or create laws in this country to prevent people coming from Southeast Asia and particularly coming from India. And so the Direct Passage Act you look at of 1908 saying that you cannot come to this country unless you take a direct passage. So there was no direct passage from India. So then, in other words, we're saying, sorry, we don't need you. The people were adventurous. And they leased that Kamagatamaru and asked them to go back and come and pick us up from there.
Kamagatamaru, that was 1914.
1914.
So forced the ship to go back.
Absolutely.
There's a monument in Cole Harbour today.
It is. I think it's a sad part of our history as Canadians, to be very honest, to treat people the way they were treated. But some of them got killed as they landed back in Calcutta.
Today we would say you were a marginalized community. You were racialized.
We were.
Discriminated.
Absolutely. And every possible word you could use it, and it was there, but I think it depended all upon us how we wanted to adjust and grow and make inroads actually with the system.
What strategy did you use?
I think my strategy was pretty simple. With the educational level I had, I wasn't going to take a backseat to anybody for competing on a job situation. So every time I looked at the opportunity that came to me, I was able to compete. I was able to say that, hey, allow me an opportunity. I think I'll prove you wrong that I can do as good or better than my competition. And that strategy worked out for me. And one doesn't have to be scared. A lot of people just become play victims that something is happening to them. I wasn't going to play victim. Heck, my dealing with because I was in the Air Force before I came. So I still had non-Sikhs actually in the Air Force. I had British folks still left behind after 47 in the Air Force. And my dealing with different communities was pretty much at par. I didn't see any difficulty dealing.
I get the sense you never thought for a moment that you would go back after you came here.
I don't think so. I think people always think that they wanted to go back. You don't make a move that lightly. I never wanted to come, to be very honest. I'll tell you, my brother-in-law used to write me, say that, why don't you come to Canada? I said, who wants to be pulling lumber, in a lumber sawmill? I'm enjoying my job in an office. I push the button, a peon shows up quickly and brings my cup of tea and samosa. So why do I want to be coming there? Then eventually you look at the system. I looked at to bring a change in the country, even in the Air Force that I was in. We were still working with the old Air Force regs, going back to 1930s and 40s. And you proposed a change. Hey guys, let's modernize some of those rules and the laws. So it takes a long time. Let's work within what we have. Status quo is acceptable. Someone like me, who was progressive and active and more aggressive, wanted to see change. We said, heck with it. I don't want this for all my life sitting here. Yeah, sure, I'll draw a pension actually when I retire. But
you were an ambitious guy. That's what brought you to Canada.
Absolutely. That was the same exact question that the immigration officer asked me at the time of interview. He says, you have a reasonable job. You make a good money. And where do you want to go? I said, look, I'm not happy, first of all. Secondly, I see the opportunities for me in country like Canada are vast.
Are you atypical of your generation of immigrants who came here?
I would say
you say most likewise were ambitious?
I was ambitious, and there were quite a few people who were coming in too, but still taking a backseat, you know, despite having education, you know, being shy, not wanting to really make inroads and getting stuck in manual labors. And that's, I saw the trend. I used to tell them, come on, you got, you're even better educated. Some of them were better educated than me.
I'm going to say you're a first Trudeau Canadian.
Merci beaucoup. Thank you.
And you were... You were very much part of an ambitious group who were prepared to take the risk.
Absolutely.
To come to this place and never saw yourself as being victimized.
No. I would never. I would not even use that term at all.
How would you handle overt discrimination?
Well, the issue was actually a dialogue with people. Open a dialogue. And I was not shy of opening a dialogue. Somebody called me names, you know, I would say, hold it. Let me tell you who I am. And it was even in management when I got into management very quickly. I would say no more than 6 months actually of my initial life that I worked on a laborer's job, common laborers, and then got into supervision and managerial functions. And even some of the senior managers then addressing us as Hindus, I had to stop actually a vice president in my company and basically say, hold it. I'm not a Hindu.
A very important point.
I said, let me clarify who I am first of all. I said, don't start addressing. I said, that's almost actually calling names, you know, when people who they are not.
When did you think of yourself as an unhyphenated Canadian, or have you ever?
I always thought I was unhyphenated Canadian. I mean, the day I got my citizenship obviously gave me the pride, the proudest moment. That time, the time lapse was roughly about 5 years. After 5 years, you could apply, but it took you another year or so to get it. So, but I think I got my citizenship in 1977, finally. I basically said to myself, you know, I'm not hyphenated. I'm as equal to anybody else as anyone else thinks that.
But why William Slate?
Because that's where my in-laws were.
So always the family connection.
Always family connection took there. Because you got to look at, you know, who's going to assess you. You're not sure whether you're going to find a job next day. And so they were there. The house was there. So there's zero cost. Look at it. You know, but you get free boarding and lodging, which is a custom actually in our faith.
Say that again.
Yeah. Free boarding and lodging, which is customary actually in our faith, and all Sikhs, well, or any South Punjabis. You walk into any Punjabi's home, you walk in tomorrow, guard, we'll provide you a room and board actually, you know, if you don't have anywhere else. That's who we are. This is how we have been raised actually.
Does that explain, at least in part, how people deal with the very high housing costs in this very expensive city?
That's right. To some extent, it does. You know, people share, you know, they provide and help them.
Well, let's go directly there. One of the truly iconic building forms, homes, in Vancouver is called the Vancouver Special.
Yeah.
So when I say that, what does come to your mind? What's a Vancouver Special?
Well, Vancouver Special, when I look at that, is a small, tiny little cubby hole somewhere downtown, actually, and it's beyond reach for an average person from either rental or from buying aspect of it. New couples would have challenges actually to buy a place, and that's what goes through my mind.
Well, I think I've got some history for you then.
Yeah.
So the Vancouver Special, as I understand it, is a pattern design. No architect involved.
Okay.
Just go get the plans. You get it stamped. This was back in the 60s.
Okay.
Primarily. And you'd find a lot, typically on the east side.
Build anywhere, huh?
And you'd build to the maximum density allowed, ostensibly a single-family house, but it's designed in such a way that it can be immediately cut into upper and lower floors, balcony out front. A lot of other Vancouver specials occupies blocks and blocks, affordable housing for its time. And you know who predominantly built them?
Who?
South Asians.
Is that right?
And I think they built them for their families. They knew exactly what they needed, and they designed then built them, you know, to adjust the plumbing.
Yeah.
And everybody knew. At City Hall, it was, of course, known that these would get cut up into effectively suites, but it would all be the same family. So in a way, still a single-family house.
Absolutely.
I think that's what I saw when I took my bike trip in Syria. Now, even they were kind of McMansions. But it's really struck me that the same thing was going on, that Punjabis were building the kind of housing that had worked for them from where they came from, where the previous generations came, and what they expect to live in today. Is that true?
It is. I mean, you see those mansions right now. As I walk in the morning, actually, from my house, and I see them, you know, then look at that. You know, maybe there are six or seven or eight cars or vehicles of different sizes actually parked in a house. And then it obviously tells me that they either have the close relatives all together, every kid having a vehicle staying there, or they have found a way actually to bring in the next closest actually thing actually to a tenant actually to live there. So, but people are out there to help them.
So if I grew up in one of those homes, would I expect to live in one in the future, or is Vancouver even becoming too expensive for the next generation of...
If you grew up in a Sikh family, I'll tell you one thing. You know, as a teenagers, youngsters, until you were really able to settle on your own, you'll be staying at no cost with your parents. Very few parents would say to their children that, hey, folks, I want to charge you, and you're now 18, you better be earning. They say, no, that's fine. Thank you very much. Stay here. Make a couple bucks. Actually, if you're working, save those dollars, actually, eventually to buy a place.
Right. This is, I think, the way it's done.
Yeah.
And the reason why a very expensive city still has people who come from, what, middle income or...
Yeah.
Well, what did happen economically to the Sikh community? Here's the wave that comes in the 70s. Bit of a depression back then, I think, but the economy booms in British Columbia. They're able to buy homes, find jobs, build temples, commercial. Was it a time seemingly of prosperity and promised land?
I think when you look back, there are two or three things that actually that stand out for a Sikh family. First and foremost, they like to have a roof over their heads. They like to build a place. And that's just why you find even families who are here for a short duration of their stay, they ultimately try to get one into actually, even if they get a smaller place. And
this Canadian dream, yeah, I think that's typical of most cultures, though.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And that's what they wanted. And the Sikhs were, initially, I remember people staying, you know, coming singles in the even in the 70s wave. And when I looked at it, 8, 10, 15, 20 of them staying actually in a large, you know, 8, 10 bedroom type of thing, sometimes taking shifts actually to sleep and ensuring that they were able to save enough to go on their own. That's one thing that happens with the community. Building a Sikh, we don't call it a temple. We call it a gurdwara.
Gurdwara.
Because I'll tell you there's a bit of a difference. Actually, temples would have idols to worship. We don't have one. And so we only worship the word, actually, the actual writing and the spiritual message in our scripture.
This is closer to Judaism, isn't it?
When you look at comparatively the belief in oneness of God, similar to Judaism, Christianity, or Islam, but I don't take it lightly, the next sentence that I'm going to use it, let's say it factually, basically. Judaism and Christianity and Islam would say, yes, we all believe in one God and everyone is equal in his eyes. When you try to define, you say that Jews will say that we are the chosen people. In other words, you become superior than you and me. And then Christianity would say that it's only Son of God and the Christ is the only Savior actually that can really sail you across the ocean of sins type of things. Okay, then you take Islam, who says, you know, Muhammad was the last prophet ever to be walking on this earth. And in our case, Gord, we take actually that this is the universal God. And we do not, we say, yes, Sikh founders, Guru Nanak, tried to create an egalitarian society to the extent that, you know, everyone is equal. Christians, Muslims, Islams, Hindus, Buddhists, Jews, you talk about it, we're all equal.
Are you a religious scholar in some sense? Or are you just a Sikh who knows?
I'm an average Sikh. Who knows, who at least practices my religion. That's what I, this way. That's what you do. You know, when you practice, you try to know who you are.
So from your roots to your arrival to the time you spent in this community, how has religion and the community changed?
It's gone through transformations in many ways. Initial challenges were that turban was the impediment for the Canadians to accept it. In fact, even in my own personal situations, my initial few months working actually as a common laborer in a lumber company, my boss would walk by and say that, again, if you didn't have the turban, you'll be a supervisor tomorrow because of your abilities and language skills. And I became a weak individual, Gord. And to this day, I regret that I did that.
That you did what?
I took my turban off.
You did?
I took my turban off for 10 years. And you wouldn't believe it how I came back into the fold. We had built a Clear Gurdwara in Williams Lake, and I was the president for the Gurdwara without a turban. And when I every time I went to the Gurdwara, I tied my turban. And this was the Vaisakhi day, you know, that you now see quite exuberantly celebrated, actually, all over the world, and especially here. And I had a lot of my non-Sikh Canadians sitting in the audience that day. And so I spoke on the significance of my articles of faith, including turban. And one of my friends, John Boss, was sitting there. He kept on looking at me. I didn't know what he was really gauging. And as I finished talking, and so this was my mine was the ending speech anyway. So he grabbed me by the arm and takes me out actually of the Gurdwara and says, "I want to talk to you." I said, no, let's eat." He said, "No, I want to talk to you first." So he takes me out and he says, "You know, Gyan, I don't know how to tell you." And I look at you. If I had been listening to you with my eyes closed, I was really impressed with what you said and what the significance of your religious articles of faith are. But he says, "I know you. You'll take your turban off as you walk out. And I have never seen your kirpan actually on you. I see your bracelet." He said, "That's fine." And he kept on saying, he said, "What a phony guy you are."
Have to be a good friend to say that.
Absolutely. To this day, you know, and I thank him. And I could have offered a lot of excuses to him, saying that, you know, hey, I'm doing it because this is the way I can put, I have a better job and blah, blah. I was also teaching on the side, you know, in Caribou College. And I said, how would my there was no Sikh students there. You know, how would they perceive me or take me actually with the turban type of thing? But I didn't want to offer any excuses. I said, "John, you are right. Next week, when I walk back and speak in this place, I'll be an initiated Sikh."
You took the turban off, and you were clean shaven in order to get a better job.
Absolutely,
that's a good strategy. But by 10 years, you could put it back on.
Yeah.
Does that also reflect a change in the community in Canada?
It did. It did. You know, people seeing that folks coming back into the fold of their roots, looking at it, you know, hey, you are who you are, no matter what you said. Because I found even after taking the turban off, you know, I wasn't going to be able to change the color of my skin. And I wasn't going to be able to change my features. I was still who I was. When people looked at me, the only difference was without turban, I was still the same individual. But with turban, in fact, I was more loyal and committed to not only to myself, but also carried a message of treating everyone equal, what I was saying. It emphasizes that, hey, when you have a turban, there are certain obligations that go with that, and those obligations are to treat everyone equal.
Yeah, when you're walking even through this library today, downtown Vancouver, and you see people looking at you, I bet you can tell in a fraction of a second how they're assessing you.
Absolutely. I mean, you see the piercing eyes sometimes, but I think Vancouver over the years, God, has changed. You don't have those stares that you used to get maybe a few decades ago. and now maybe a curious eye, those would be the one that they haven't seen.
But that would be a great way to measure the change in the stare factor.
Absolutely.
Young people today, a young man today, growing up in the Newton Wally era,
yeah,
would he put on a turban?
Absolutely. There are more.
More.
It's amazing what I see. See, there were certain challenges. See, people look at who they are. It doesn't matter which background we all come from. Ultimately, you know, as you are gone past the teenager life, you're trying to find your own identity. Who are you? And some of those kids growing up, you know, they were having challenges asking their parents to explain. Their parents didn't have enough knowledge really to explain and answer some of those questions. And with the advent of obviously social media and everything else, now you can only go and seek answers. It may not be 100% right, but at least you can have some answers.
Well, I'm thinking on one hand, social media would show you examples of people you could be.
Yeah.
But it's also an incredibly secular culture here.
Absolutely.
A lot of peer pressure at that age. What is it that has brought the turban back into the lives of young men?
Issue is that there's more peer pressures, I agree, especially when you're non-conforming to your own root. I see in students, and I hear that because I've got grandchildren who've gone through the high schools now and more into university and everywhere else. But I look at that. They would say, if I had a turban, No one would actually really say much about it and put any pressure on me. If I didn't have one, then there is one. And I mean, it's amazing. I mean, I look at universities. When my children were going through the universities, I've said that quite proudly, that there were three of my kids with a boy with the turban, and even my daughter with the turban, and the other one with the scarf. And then there were three other kids, total seven kids, actually, who had turbans or were practicing Sikhs.
And today, if you wandered into the atrium of Simon Fraser in Surrey?
Hundreds. Hundreds,
yes.
All born and raised here.
I'm wondering if it's also a great fashion accessory. And I don't mean this lightly. I saw a man at an All Candidates meeting at Simon Fraser. He had on a white jacket and a white turban. And I got to say, he looked almost like a prince. It was stunning. And I'm thinking, that's a look. The turban is a great way to get a look. Now, am I being too slight about this? I recognize its relevance and importance.
I think no, you're not, because I find among Sikhs some of them who are not even initiated, even some girls, they wear turban. And it may be because of a fashion, but also trying to actually get into it and not adopting all the prerequisites of being I use the term initiation, as you see, rather than a baptism, because there's slightly difference in our way of initiation. So rather than accepting all the responsibilities of an initiated Sikh, you know, they basically start tying turbans, and you could call it a fashion, but a lot of people actually are not initiated and they still wear turbans.
So by the 1980s, you're now well employed and you're seeing the growth in numbers. And then 1984. I didn't really realize until I read your book, An Uncommon Road, what a profound and traumatic year that was. How did it change or affect things here in Metro Vancouver? And past, you'll have to explain just what happened in 1984.
It was 80s until the early 80s. Folks were really, you know, getting along, the life was normal. When the year 84 comes in, the attack by the government of India's armed forces on our sacred place of worship, the sacred place, I would call it.
Equivalent to Vatican of its own?
Yeah, folks call it, commonly called the Golden Temple, but we call it the Darbar Sahib. And killing of certain innocent people, which is what caused the huge, huge heartbreak for people like ourselves. Some of us had were practicing Sikhs, but we were probably not as concerned what was going on in the country of your birth. But that impacted all of us. And especially, I was personally reformed, you can call it, right after that, you know, thinking that we better do something to highlight the human rights violations that have gone on, or innocent people getting killed.
And then it got even, in a sense, worse, the killing of Indira Gandhi by a Sikh bodyguard.
Yeah, Sikh bodyguard, who were...
A mass slaughter that followed?
Yeah, it's an unfortunate...
So this is trauma of a very high cultural order, in a way. But how did it affect the people here?
God, everybody had a relative or a friend or somebody else who got killed in that, at that time. I doubt if there's any family that had, did not lose some members through the process of extermination, I would call it. You know, what happened in Amritsar in 84, and then later on in October, November, first week of November in Delhi, was not, no less than actually a genocide of the groups, the people. And, you know, you've got to, I mean, you're an avid reader. You can read, pick up. I picked up, I read and talk to people whose houses were marked. And these were highly employed people. They were like deputy ministers, actually. He says, my house was even marked, and someone calls me, is this your car number? I said, what would you ask me to? You know, that means, you know, they were marking the house. These are sick houses, taking voters list, and then sending actually gangs, actually hoodlums to go and kill them. A story of a woman that I have not forgotten, actually, that... And she was published in January 85 by a human rights watch group actually there, and saying that how she was raped in front of her son, you know, by youngsters, and it is traumatic. And
traumatic.
It is to the extreme, and it just goes right down to your core of who you are and what kind of people would do that kind
and
of.
And at this point, thousands of Sikhs are coming to Vancouver in this immigration wave, so this would all be very fresh.
It'll be, yeah, absolutely. I mean, they were getting, they were already escaping because the whole agitation. It all started as a peaceful agitation, John.
Then after 84, are they actually fleeing the Punjab?
They were. There was no youngster was safe, to be very honest. I mean, it went on for almost 11, 12 years after that. There was a total extermination. But if they saw a youngster walking, he was picked up, or she was picked up, they were girls.
Did it come as a wave the community had to respond to, rather like the Syrians who were arriving?
Well, community had to get together, definitely to find a strategy. You know, how can we highlight? You know, definitely different groups were formed at that time, you know, and so I led one group, actually, the World Sikh Organization, basically with a very clear vision of saying that, you know, our role is really to highlight and protect the community. And how do we do it, actually? You know, how do we really bring up the facts? Because what was coming out through the media, it's sad, you know, even the Western media, certainly, you know, some of them were really probing, but the many were just actually buying the information.
A little later, the Air India bombing.
Yeah, it led to it. It's a sad
trauma after another coming to this. Was it a tightly knit community?
Air India disaster is one of the worst disasters that happened in our history. We all acknowledge, and Sikhs do acknowledge as well, acknowledge that. And it has hurt it not only killing of innocent 329 people, but also a lot of children in that. Them all, mostly majority Canadians, and there was no justification for that to happen. And it became almost an albatross for the Sikh community to carry, especially those of us who were initiated to wearing turbans.
Let me ask you a difficult hypothetical question. Do you think if there was a large Hindu population at the same time in Vancouver, that there would have been animosity?
I think animosity was... there was a bit of animosity there anyway, even with the smallest or large. It always happens. Hindu community was here and all. I mean, I always emphasize that, you know, you can't actually drag the whole community. Within the community, you'll always find certain elements, you know, that would cause you a bad name, irrespective of whether Sikhs, Hindus, or Christians, or anybody else, you know, or any background people, you can have that. I think they're there. I don't think the community was trying to really cope up with these tragic situations and be open. And if you, when you see the accusations flying at you every day, I think you probably read in one note, you know, I was in a parade at the July... July parade actually in Williams Lake. You know, a youngster, 12 years old... smiling and smirking and looking at me, asking, hey, when is the next plane going to be bombed, type of thing. You know, that tells you it had entered the psyche of actually our Canadian population as if a turban was somehow conflated with the extremism and terrorism.
Was there a sense then in this growing, vibrant community that we had progressed so much and now are under siege again?
We felt at that time that, we were taken back 25 years somehow. That it'll take us a long time to really rebuild our character and rebuild our reputation as a community that's there to really serve and treat everyone equal. I think
it take 25 years?
It didn't take 25. I think we've been working every day. You can call it 25 or maybe even longer, but I think we had a strategy that we're going to work. We're going to educate. Education is the vehicle that we adopted somehow to really tell our neighbors, telling you and telling, if my neighbor next door actually doesn't know who I am, then why don't I just walk over and break bread with them and saying that, hey, folks, this is who I am. Don't look at me at least from a different angle. I'm no different than you. What kids could.
Well, I suspect it would have been very difficult back then to have imagined that there would be a leader of a major party, a turban Sikh, with the possibility maybe prime minister.
I don't think we even imagined, or even having 18, 20 people actually in the Canadian Parliament and having four of them actually in cabinet, we did not imagine. But we did have a strategy, to be very honest, actually as a community, going back and saying, even in 84, we looked at it, we said, okay, how are we going to be, what is the decision-making process in this country? Is it a political, is it a bureaucratic, or is it actually a board? Or how do you really get into and then start actually showing that, hey, folks, you are no different than others? And I think it took us, we had envisioned that in about 20 years, perhaps, we will probably get people into Parliament. But, it only took 9 years, by the way, when we elected the first two, one from Ontario, Gurbakhsh Malli, and Dhaliwal from here.
Punjabis seem to be pretty darn good at politics.
I think politics somehow, actually, back in in India is one, I don't call it a profession, but I think it's their passion, electing people. Somehow, they get involved. I mean, you look at the numbers even today, I think you'll probably find over 70, or in some polls, 80, 87% people polling. And hey, Canada can only dream about it. I mean, we sometimes...
Well, you can make a very good case that the current provincial government is in office because of some ridings, heavily Punjabi, because they were able to appeal to their self-interest. Let's talk taxi. I'm struck by the ability of, I think it may be true of many, many different immigrant groups will come together to protect their, support their interests. But it does strike me that Punjabis are really darn good at it.
Well, I think you struck a nerve there and said that, yes, the government will not be in power if at least three MLAs I know right now who defeated the sitting cabinet ministers and other people, if the community had not switched their allegiance actually to the NDP.
That, folks, is called politics.
It is. You look at it. But the sad part, again, Gord, is that do people really remember? Do politicians really remember? I don't know. Sometimes I have my doubts.
Remember what?
Remember that, you say that, okay, certain things that if a community supports you, that means there was a bit of an agenda for them as well. Hey, how would you bring about certain changes, maybe the difficulties or challenges?
Did he follow through on his promises? Well,
did he follow through on his promises? I don't think so.
You'll be interested to know. At least one political science study I've read is about 80%.
Yeah.
It's way higher than people think. We're all kind of got our cheap cynicism when it comes to politics.
I know we do. We do.
All right. So, who is we when you talk about we had a strategy to look where the power was and to be there?
Well, when we talk we talk about the broader community, and we as an organization, I talk it actually, we founded a World Sikh organization, which was an international organization, first of all, and a Canadian branch, which I headed. I was the founding president of that organization.
Is there a strong relationship between the Gurdwara and the organization around, say, religion and political organization?
We stay apolitical type of things. You know, we say that we, and in fact, we warn our people that you have the individual rights to support any party, but if someone actually is in an executive position, you cannot take side. Because don't you want a perception that you're supporting one party over the other? That's right. First. And Gurdwara associations is always there. We take it on issue by issue. Some Gurdwaras will come and support you. The others will say, no, we don't want to support you. But the issue is, ours is actually a universality of actually issues we take. We don't take actually just for the Sikh community alone. We will take it for non-Sikhs. And we have defended Gurd, the Jewish community's right to actually build a sukkah hut. And we've taken actually a Scottish boy from Alberta who wanted to wear kilt at graduation, and nobody else wanted to touch him. And we did that. And then everybody got on board. Actually, even the media picked up a story. We've taken a Muslim young girl who was playing soccer, actually wanted to wear hijab. And, you know, we don't shy away.
You took a position on one issue very close to me.
We took a position on one issue, which actually got me death threats actually on gay marriages. And we said to ourselves, you know, that, hey, if the Canadian Charter of Rights gives me the privilege and the right to wear my articles of faith, who am I to tell someone else how to behave? And that goes back to the root of my personal beliefs or my religious beliefs, treating everyone equally. You know, each individual deserve to live their life as they wish.
You supported the act that would effectively legalize gay marriage.
Yeah, we certainly.
There was some controversy within your community.
Absolutely, there was. You know, people, some on to the more orthodox. You know, I consider myself actually in that group as well. But they were actually even people who were not even visually practicing. You know, wearing turbans or otherwise. You know, but their thought viewpoints were so orthodox to the extreme, saying that you know they would say no. You know, we were wrong.
Well, that seems typical of immigrant communities that come from more conservative cultures. They'll bring some of that.
Well, it always comes along, but you have to be looking ahead. You know, what harm were they doing? They were not imposing to really walk into your gurdwara and get.
But you were looking at all of these issues, whether with Jewish community or the gay community, through the filter of what it would mean if you weren't able to support a different group.
Absolutely.
It would mean that's how you would be treated.
That's high, exactly. You know, I mean, you always have to put yourself in that shoe and say that, what if I'm there? I know that the Jewish community came to my defense when Colonel Joel's turban actually became an issue in the Legion halls. And the Jewish community stood beside me, actually, at the same press release, and saying that, hey, look, you know, this is how we want it, actually. And other communities actually have come to work with us. And you got to build your own alliances. If you go individually, you're all going to be losing.
So now the alliances of, to use the term, marginalized groups are the majority.
Well,
52% of the people in Vancouver are, quote, people of color, and that's largely Asian and South Asian. And again, in your lifetime, you've just seen that happen with astonishing rapidity.
It has. You know, I mean, I can't even believe it, to be very honest, you know, but to me, it now looks like, you know, this is what Canada is all about.
Well, does the community scale up to the point where people can live internally, speak the language, do commerce only with others of their group, whether it be Chinese on Number 3 Road or Sikhs on King George Boulevard? Is there a danger when you get to a certain size that things go internal and you don't feel as much now, even a marginalized part of a bigger community?
It's got a twofold impact, actually, what I see. Some people might be actually thinking in that context, but most of us who are in business, you start a business to serve the community at large. You don't start a business to serve a small pocket. Some people might on a smaller scale.
You're not a small pocket.
I know.
You're one of the largest communities.
Yeah, largest pocket, you can call it. I mean, you have certain malls, actually, that would cater to that community. There's no question about it, because whether it's food. But you also look at, you know, you got the biggest food chains now carrying, actually, foods, actually, from India.
This is Vancouver.
Yeah.
And 2019,
yeah.
I can go to a mall in Richmond, I can go to a mall in Newton,
yep.
And I feel like I'm enveloped in not a small pocket.
No, that's true.
Cultural community. Is there a danger there?
I say to some extent, Yes. Okay, let me say, when I qualify, actually, when I say yes. If people really try to really ghettoize, actually, into a given segment of a society, you know, you do run a danger of your kids growing up today not having the exposure to the broader community and adjusting, actually, say, 50 years from now or 20 years from now. And this is one of the emphasis I personally place on when I talk to youngsters. Said, hey, kids growing up in smaller communities, we had... I give my own example. Our kids were actually, their friends were quote-unquote white kids, okay? I mean, they were coming to our places, and our kids were dealing with them, and that's how they grew up in every scenario. And sometimes you will see in Newton, though people may not like it, actually the way I've paraphrased it, in a sense that if a kid growing up in Surrey sometimes doesn't want to go out of the community, and he just stays within it, and his friends are Punjabis, and he goes and he speaks Punjabi, learns Punjabi, and does everything else Punjabi. You know, you got all the services in Punjabi. Sometimes you may have a difficulty actually getting into a higher echelon, actually adjusting in a
way. Well, do you see that actually happening? I understand the worry.
Yeah. I think in with some kids, I think it's working, but there's a concerted effort going on for educating kids to get out, to very on, hey, get out to the broader community. That's where the difference is.
When you look at other communities, let's take the Chinese, and you see now because of Hong Kong, division between those from Hong Kong, those from mainland. It may be exaggerated through the media, but it nonetheless reflects a division. Even a quick reading of a Wikipedia entry on Sikhs in British Columbia would indicate abundant divisions. Is that just something characteristic of people and community, or are there particular things about immigrant communities where those divisions become magnified?
I don't think it's specific to the immigrant communities, but I think every immigrant community that comes to a new place always has. They need to find it where they can be more comfortable. Because they were either discriminated or their parents were then saying that, okay, let's get together. At least there's a bit of a protection in or strength, actually, in numbers. And they have done that. I think people are now gone beyond that. Even families coming in from, say, India right now, specifically Punjab, you see students coming in. They're reasonably educated. Language is not a barrier. They qualify, actually, as English speakers before they even come.
Just like you.
Yes, just like me. And I talk to those youngsters and say that, you know, when I came, I didn't have a language problem either, my friends. You know, they are the contributors right now to our economic system.
And they have the internet.
And they have the internet
and the global culture.
Absolutely.
Are they all pulled into that?
Yeah. And it's not an easy for them, by the way. You know, you come from an average family who may have mortgaged all the lands and the houses to really put you on a flight to Canada and then paid actually your fees, you know, which will be anywhere $18,000 to $20,000, $30,000 fees, and then placed to stay here. It's a $60,000 to $70,000 commitment per year. And you've done that, and that's coming to Canadian coffers. And these folks actually are allowed to work 20 hours a week, and then they're contributing through taxes again. You know, we didn't pay any allowances for raising them, and there was zero cost to us. I think it's a smart move in a way. I think Canada has probably somewhere in the system thought that, my God, you know, let's get
well. There's cross ideological acceptance of that analysis. Yeah. You know, we're not shutting down immigration anytime soon.
Absolutely.
What about though the people whose roots are here, but feel anxious because they see the world that they grew up in has changed irredeemably? Let's be straightforward about it. It's changing from white to brown. Do you understand their anxiety?
I do, to some extent. You know, any community, I think it's a natural phenomena with us as humans. And we look at something that doesn't look like me. You know, my God, you know, how are they? How dare they try to
That's
influence?
That's pretty human.
Yeah, it's pretty human, you know. So, I mean, I understand that. But on the other hand, you look at it, you know, this country is actually a country that has been built actually by immigrants of different backgrounds. And where's the, I mean, if Canadians are more keen, actually, I'm now, it's a bit of a comical comment, I might make it, you know. If the couple actually in Canada doesn't want to have a child, you know, but you still want protection when you grow old, somebody's going to pay that. You got to get some people coming in from somewhere and become actually contributor to supporting you.
That's the reality now.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, people have to really get past the color of their skins and say that, you know, how are they really impacting me, positively or negatively?
On one hand, we can be very self-congratulating. The Canadian multicultural.
Oh, but absolutely. That's a nice term.
Yeah.
Nice cliche.
And you've been around long enough to know and seen and experienced maybe some danger.
Well, you know, and we see that, and it happens. You know, you're always going to have, you know, we're a very polite society. Okay? We're very, very accommodating society, at least on the surface, if if nothing else. You know, we don't really are in your face type of a community, similar to, they say, sometime I get a feel on the south of the border scenario there. You know, we even if we don't like something, we still want to be politely saying that.
Yes.
saying that, not saying that I don't like you, and
I will put up with you.
Yeah, I will put up with you. You know, that's fine.
So we have this extraordinarily fast-growing, vibrant community. I think the word is really appropriate here. There's lots of creativity happening in work. Yes, I think even in religion, in political response, all of these great things. And wealth. Bob Williams, one of the chaps we've just had a podcast with, says one of the greatest transfers of wealth is land values in Surrey. That going from market gardens to suburbs to the communities that you live in brought the Sikh, the Punjabi community, right up into the middle and upper middle class within a generation.
Yeah.
Is that an exaggeration?
No, not at all. In fact, you know, they have done fairly well. You look at the population base of Surrey of 500,000 people right now. If you're talking, say, 125,000, 150,000 people of the Sikh heritage background living in that part of that city, look at the business ownership and how aggressively they're pursuing business. They're contributing.
They're doing pretty well.
Numbers I get is about over 56% of the businesses are owned by the Sikh community.
Yeah. And so now you've gone from, well, if not poverty, you certainly had to struggle, to wealth and affluence. And so the story goes that families doted on their sons in particular, who never had any experience with this, and so saw opportunity for other kinds of commerce, whether it be drugs, status, the popular culture, and that sudden affluence of the community was what has led to the gangs and guns that now seems to be the reputation of Surrey to a great degree.
It's sad. It is.
But is that story true?
Yeah, no, it is. When I look at them, and I think I'll give you the stats. It was 2018 when I got the survey done from the World Sikh Organizations, and I said, find out how many kids have died since the year 2000, starting with 2000, last, say, 18 years. I got the number 124 from the majority, say Sikh sickly, and then some other Punjabis, non-Sikh Punjabis. And then I said, look at the number sickly, everybody else. And they were in the range of about 136. And then you compare the population. Hey, British Columbia's population is, what percentage are Sikhs? 4.5%, say, roughly 5. And we have 50%.
Your conclusion?
Our conclusion is something wrong. And something wrong drastically. Why are these kids in that? You know, I mean, the study, Gord, that I looked at was the doctoral thesis done by an RCMP officer who teaches at the Kwantlen University there, done only, I think, 4 years ago or so, basically, saying that the phenomena in British Columbia of youngsters getting into gangs is totally different compared to looking at Chicago, Vancouver, New York, or somewhere else, or London, and everybody else that he put his studies on. That here, over 50% of those youngsters who are in are coming from affluent family. I mean, money is not their focus. It's probably a lifestyle, as you were saying. You know, they're looking at it, you know, to some extent, this is a flashy life. This is what I want to lead. I mean, they're floating. And kids going to high school, I see driving $100,000 cars. Come on, give me a break.
So this is certainly not unprecedented. In fact, a good popular cultural example would be from the Mariel boatlift out of Cuba, the emergence of what the movie Scarface portrays with Al Pacino.
Yep.
And we can see other variations of it.
Absolutely. I mean, everybody.
So what is, if not a solution, how is it addressed?
I think what it needs, sure enough, you know, everybody talks about the government's putting more funds into it. Yes, I can understand, you know, there's a way that government can react. Government can react actually making, you're not making a social change there, thinking that what you did actually in Toronto, Chicago, and others there, you know, maybe let's create more jobs for these students. They better be going to school. These are already well-to-do kids, actually. And so how do you really take their attention away from that? And this is where the community comes and has to play a major role. This is where the parents have to start playing a major role. Don't just actually bankroll the kids actually when they go to be 16, 18 years old and buy them a car. Actually, that's
well, I'm guessing that's already happening. I would think the number of deaths and the just you always know someone or a family.
Yeah.
It must be having an effect on how kids are being raised now.
It is having it. Yeah, people, you know, you end up knowing within the community, the parents and the devastation they go through after the child is actually assassinated. And it's not something that you take it lightly even as a community.
So how is that? What do you see in how children are being raised now that's different?
I think going back 30, 40, 50 years, you know, we were instilling in their minds how hard work and ethics played a role for you to succeed. And the current trend, sometime I find, not only necessarily limited to the Sikhs, but even other minorities, thinking that money plays a major role. That, hey, it's money, doesn't matter how you earn. Every family is not like that. I mean, you can't generalize it, but you'll find a percentage of families who would always put a focus on that. Don't worry, son or a daughter. You know, you want whatever you want is available to you. I say we have to stop doing that. We have to really get back to the real thing. You know, look at who we are. We live in a country that's, I mean, you entered at the start of our discussions there. I call it heaven on earth, to be very honest. You know, this is a country that provided me the opportunities and the joy of life that I'm having it. And everybody has the same opportunities. Make the best of it. You can succeed by being actually ethical. You can succeed by working hard. And you can succeed actually, you know, by not getting into drugs.
Gad, your community has done all that.
Absolutely. Yeah, they have done it. Yeah, absolutely.
It's achieved a Canadian dream, right down to the ostensibly single-family house.
Absolutely.
In a suburban setting with all of the apparatus of middle-class life, at least.
Absolutely. I know
what now? We talk about change, whether light rail or SkyTrain, more prosperity, more people, immigration still. What's going to change in your community in this now, this chapter of your life?
I think what's going to happen is that people have to start getting back into contributing to the total overall society rather than looking narrowly at contributing to the segment of...
Well, we call those taxes.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right.
Not only taxes, Mr. Price, but I will tell you, you know, you look at other avenues. You know, there's a lot of charitable work that goes on. I mean, you see people contributing even through Guru Nanak Kitchen. You'd see on the international scene, people going on and serving in Iraq. There's different ways of contributing it. Once you made it...
Remarkable leadership in that.
Oh, absolutely.
If I were biking through your neighborhood today, yep, what kind of house would I see that you live in and... What's the neighborhood like?
Well, I live in won't call it a mansion. Actually, I'm an average Sikh. Certainly have lived a good life. And it's a 5,200 square foot place, actually, and three floors. And my wife and I live there.
Just you two?
Just two of us. And we have adopted a refugee family recently from Afghanistan. So rather than putting them on somewhere else, we said, okay, we'll keep that family with us. And I'm sure within a few months, they'll be gone on their own. Then we're back again, wife and I. You know, it's a place that we feel that our children and grandkids, when they get together, at least, you know, they got a place.
Are the other houses on your block the same?
Oh, they're bigger than me.
Ah.
Oh, no. My next door, two houses are just beside me on either side are 8,500 to 9,000 square foot homes.
Where do you go shopping? Where do you get your groceries?
Right. I think within the same region there.
Do you have to drive?
You have to drive. And I'm not a very good, actually, shopper, I think. Yeah, my partner, and my wife does, then she's a better person to do it, if you can believe it.
Sounds wise.
For many, many, many years, I never even got out of, especially when I lived on Williams Lake. It's a good, we got a laugh one day, you know, that was good. I was free, and then my wife said, let's go a little shopping. I said, shopping, what? You know, no, drive me around. So I went there, and I walked into a store, and she said, people are going to think I brought you in from India. And here I've lived in that town. People knew my name from a business point of view, but I was not normally a shopper. But now I have learned, actually, I think that I'm at an age where I feel that I better be contributing, actually, since my 14, 18 hours a day job is not there anymore, so I don't do that. And but sort of,
would you go for a walk?
I do go for a walk every day. That's my routine.
Where do you go?
So in the neighborhood, actually, I walk into there are small parks there as well. I mean, Surrey is a city of parks with 600 parks, I suppose, and every neighborhood has a park you can walk through and have a leisurely, really walk and good fresh air through the forest.
If you could change something significant in your community, in your neighborhood, what would that be?
I think you would basically beautify it definitely more than what it is right now.
Oh, tell me more. What do you mean beautiful?
Yeah. You know,
what would you make more beautiful?
Well, you can make the places more beautiful actually by, you know, not let people cut all the trees in their yards, to be honest. leave all the trees and put a lot more emphasis on greenery, which is already there. But I think pave some of the roads, at least. You still got some potholes in Surrey. I see that there are no sidewalks actually in some of the roads that I walk through. I mean, hey, these are the places that people have mansions clear and on those streets, and then you don't even have sidewalks to walk. You know, I mean, if I was on the city council, that's what I would be looking at.
This is so good news, I have to say again. You and every other Metro Vancouverite, certainly every Vancouverite, share exactly the same desires.
Absolutely. You know, we're
greener,
you know, we're all humans,
livable.
All think alike.
So no reason why Sikhs won't be building a vibrant community well into the future.
It's there. It'll continue to be a vibrant community. The Sikhs are very, very aggressive, actually, in a sense that, and more adventurous rather than aggressive, I would call it. They'll get into, they are risk takers. They'll build the community, and then they'll look ahead and say, hey, what can I do here? And how can I make it more palatable, actually, for everybody?
Do you think I or my children would be influenced by your culture?
I don't think that the influence in a sense actually but you might be envious in a way.
Yeah.
And which I see that, you know, I see some of the people, I mean, in my companies, you know.
Would there be a moment if I went to a Vasiki where I become part of the parade? And
you are part of the parade. You know, you walk through Surrey actually right now on Vaisakhi parade. I mean, we talk about 500,000 people. We don't have 500,000 Sikhs living here. You know, you already got. You will be part of it. You know,
exactly.
You would be no difference at all. I see every cultural background people actually in that parade.
We're hybridizing.
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, you appreciate that. Hey, you're learning something. If nothing else, you enjoy the food.
Where Bhangra flows into whatever the contemporary music form is these days. Where fashion.
Fashion is big.
Now, I can't put on a turban.
She certainly can.
I can.
Why not?
Would it not be disrespectful?
It won't be disrespectful. If you are smoking, that would be disrespectful. If a non-smoker puts a turban on, not a problem at all.
I like that.
Yeah. See, there are certain things that people aren't aware of, Eddie, you know, because when you put a turban, there are certain obligations. You don't drink and you don't smoke. Do I really find 100% people? There are some people who wear turbans and drink, and I'm almost ashamed, to be very honest, as a Sikh, saying that, hey, they're not living up to their tenets of their own faith. Don't do certain things, you know, and don't smoke. So I will, anybody can wear. We have had turban tying events, you know, even right on Canada 150, if you can believe it, in Ottawa or in any different towns we had it. Even here in Abbotsford we had it. And Ottawa, the biggest attraction on the Parliament Hill was our tent. where the turpentine was going on. Global.
But if I thought there were certain times of the year
where
I would wear the turban.
Absolutely, even for the summer, it's good actually to keeps you cool.
So, eventually, it becomes part of my culture.
Absolutely,
that's part of my identity.
Look back, were people not covering heads? Going back to historically, for centuries back.
This 70-year-old guy would love to look like that.
Yeah,
I don't know, 25-year-old in the white turban and the white.
And there are a lot of Sikhs actually who hail from the quote unquote white community, right? Especially in California.
Hey, Gan, I think we'd better hang out long enough just to see this happen.
Yeah,
because I think there's a very good possibility
it's happening. People will adopt it as a fashion first, and then it'll probably come in as a commitment. And I talk to people who have the beauty of our religion. We don't actually really go and preach for conversion at all. We don't do that. We don't say, hey, folks, become a Sikh. No. You do what you want to do, what you like doing. And
first the fashion statement, then the belief.
Absolute.
What a great hour it's been. Love talking about this. So much insight. Thanks again.
Thank you very much. Pleasure really talking to you. It's certainly a pleasure. God bless you.